From SDPB Radio, I'm Josh Heyer, and you're listening to the In the Moment News Podcast. Each week, In the Moment with Lori Walsh brings you news and arts coverage from across the state. Listen live at 11 a.m. Central, 10 Mountain on SDPB Radio, or tell your smart speaker, play SDPB. You can find every In the Moment segment at listen.sdpb.org or subscribe to the In the Moment Segments Podcast. And now, it's your weekly roundup in news coverage. A recent release of the April jobs report put the nation's unemployment rate at about 15%. Neil Kashkari, president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, fears that the unemployment rate is understated and the real number is much higher. He joined SDPB's Jackie Hendry Monday for this conversation.
Mr. Kashkari, welcome to the program. Thanks for taking the time to visit with us.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be with you.
So I know news this morning, the Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell is suggesting that the economic rebound isn't likely till maybe even the end of 2020. In your point of view, how surprising is that expectation?
I agree with the chairman. I mean, unfortunately, what we've learned over the past couple months has not been good news. The virus is dictating the course of the economy, and the virus continues to spread across the country. People continue to get it. Sadly, people are being hospitalized and people are dying. Ultimately, what's going to determine the pace of the recovery is all of us. When we all feel safe to take our families back out to restaurants, to movie theaters, to go back to the way life was like just a few months ago. And until we feel safe, I think the recovery is going to be slower than we would like. And so I think, as the chairman said, we will see some economic growth toward the end of this year, but that's from a very low base given the contraction that we are now experiencing. It'll probably take a year or two before the economy returns to where it was before the crisis.
Well, and certainly a lot of that, we talked about the safety piece and also very basically that kind of unemployment piece. A lot of people are hurting right now. I want to turn to the April jobs report, as we mentioned in the intro, around 14% unemployment. Tell us a little bit why you expect that number is actually higher.
Well, yes. A couple weeks ago, the unemployment rate came out 14.7%, which is very high in history, much higher than it was. We had very low unemployment in February, 3.5%. But that 14.7% number understates the true magnitude of the job losses, because the way that survey is done, people have to actively be looking for work. If you answer the survey and you say, I'm not looking for work, then you're not counted as unemployed. Well, many people lost their jobs and we've been sheltering in place. We've told people to stay home. So if they lost their job and they're staying home, they're probably not out there looking for work. And so they're not counted as unemployed. And then many others said that they're on furlough, essentially, meaning they think that their job has been temporarily suspended and they hope to go back at some point. The longer this goes on, unfortunately, many of those temporary layoffs are going to become permanent layoffs. So I think the real unemployment number is probably right now around 24%, would be my best guess, just based on how many people have filed for unemployment insurance in the past couple months.
Hmm. Looking ahead a little bit, what are you expecting maybe that correction for that underreporting perhaps to come in the May jobs report when these furloughs potentially turn into those permanent layoffs? Or when should we expect to see the number be a little more accurate to what's probably really happening?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think May and then in the June report will probably unfortunately see that official unemployment number continue to trend higher. I mean, one small piece of good news, and it's all relative, mm-hmm. is that the number of people filing for unemployment insurance has started to decline. Now it's only, and I say that in quotation marks, only 3 million last week, down from 5 or 6 just a few weeks ago. But that's a huge number still. And so there's still enormous pain that's being felt across the country and across the economy, and no one is really being spared.
Wow. We mentioned history. I wonder if you can put this in a little bit of a historical context for us, people seeing headlines about highest unemployment since the Great Depression, for instance. How are we looking at this in a historical perspective?
Well, that's right. This is the most extreme job losses that we've experienced as a country since the Great Depression. The Great Depression had very high unemployment for many years. Mm. And part of the reason the Great Depression was as terrible as it was because policymakers did the wrong things. The Federal Reserve kept interest rates really high. There were tariffs that were imposed. Those made the downturn prolonged and much more damaging to the economy and to the American people. I think that we've learned from that, and the Federal Reserve is acting very aggressively to provide support into the economy and into financial markets. And even more importantly, Congress, Republicans and Democrats have come together and taken very aggressive action to support the American people through this pandemic. And so I am optimistic that we will not be in another Great Depression. I think we can bounce back much more quickly than the Great Depression, but it's still going to be a gradual recovery relative to what we thought maybe just a month or two ago.
Probably the first, when you mentioned aggressive response to the current situation, maybe the first thing that comes to people's minds and to my mind are the $1,200 stimulus checks that have been going out. I wonder, before we touch on what that money is actually doing for people, for folks who don't have a firm grasp on the Federal Reserve and how all of this plays out, can you talk a little bit about the relationship between the Reserve and Congress and how they're maybe working together to try to right the ship a little bit right now?
Yes. So the Federal Reserve is our nation's central bank. We were created by Congress in 1913. Our jobs are to manage the ups and downs of the U.S. economy. If the U.S. economy looks like it's overheating, typically we will raise interest rates to make it more expensive for someone to get a mortgage or to buy a car or for a business to get a loan to expand because we want to cool things down. If the economy looks like it's slowing or we're heading into recession, the Federal Reserve will typically lower interest rates to try to make it cheaper to get a mortgage and boost economic activity. And we want to make sure that the financial system is functioning so we can lend money out to financial markets to keep them moving so that businesses can raise the money that they need. In contrast, Congress has the authority to tax all of us and to spend that money. They decide how much they want to tax us and what they want to spend it on, whether it's healthcare or defense or education or roads. The Federal Reserve, we are not a spending agency. We can just loan money, but we have to get it back. Congress has the ability to spend money. So what the Federal Reserve has been doing is we lowered interest rates effectively to zero because of the crisis, and we've been providing trillions of dollars of lending into the economy and into financial markets to make sure the plumbing of the financial system works. In parallel with that, Congress has passed $3 trillion of spending, the checks that you talked about to families, small business loans that are going to be forgiven for many businesses, expanded unemployment insurance. That's all spending that Congress has put forward, and it's very, very powerful.
And any lender doesn't lend unless they have relative confidence in the ability to pay back. So is that why we're seeing these interest rates going lower and these kinds of actions, because the Reserve isn't too concerned about the ability to make up for what's going out right now?
Well, we've intentionally lowered interest rates to make it cheaper. And so, you know, in theory, we could be taking more risk. But when we lower interest rates, we do it by lending money against, for example, U.S. government bonds, Treasury bonds, or government-guaranteed mortgage-backed securities. So we're not supposed to be taking credit risk, as they call it. In some of our emergency authorities that have been executed in the past couple months, we are taking more risk, but we think that's the right thing to do to try to provide support to the U.S. economy and to businesses while we navigate this downturn. In contrast, when Congress says we're going to go spend $1 trillion or spend $2 trillion, they're expecting that money all to go out the door and not to be recouped. So that's a fundamental difference between what we call monetary policy, which the Fed is in charge of, and fiscal policy, which Congress is in charge of.
Wow. Going back to kind of those discussion of checks, from your perspective, is that money doing what it was intended to do, and do we need more of the same?
Well, I think it is. I mean, I find that the most effective way to help families and workers that have been laid off is to put money in their pockets so that they can pay their bills, whether that's buying food for their families or making a car payment or rent or mortgage. You know, if we have millions of Americans and thousands of businesses that are effectively shuttered in because of the virus, they're either laid off or they've got no customers right now, this could become a much bigger economic challenge if people can't pay their rent or can't pay their mortgage, or the small business can't pay their lease then that means that their landlord can't pay their mortgage. Mm. And then it starts to ripple through the economy. So I do believe that Congress acted in a very smart manner, putting money in the pockets of people who've lost their jobs just so that they could pay their bills for their own sake, but also for the sake of the broader economy. So it doesn't then start to ripple and hit more and more businesses and more communities.
Do you think we need more of the same, or can we expect more of the same in some of these additional packages rolling out?
I think we may need more of the same. You know, a couple months ago when Congress first designed this intervention, I think we were all more optimistic that this could be a short, maybe a month or two shutdown, clamp down on the virus, get it under control, and then turn the economy back on. So many of these were meant to be short-term bridges, in a sense. Well, as we've seen, we have flattened the curve nationally on the virus, but it's still spreading. Hmm. Millions of people probably still have it. People are still dying. So there's a risk that this shutdown, some version of this shutdown, is going to be longer rather than shorter. And that means people are probably going to need more assistance to help them make ends meet.
Yeah. It's hard to imagine seeing how this will play out probably in the next year and a half or so, assuming that is in fact the case, that that's how long the recovery takes, and it seems likely at this point. I'm wondering if you can talk about, because certainly a lot of the more financially vulnerable folks are being hit the hardest by this situation. What are there additional solutions to really help out the folks that need it most?
Well, you're exactly right. I mean, this virus is disproportionately targeting lowest income Americans who have the least ability to withstand it, because it's the frontline service workers who are most losing their jobs, whether it's at restaurants or bars or coffee shops or health clubs. And in many cases, these are the folks who only recently recovered from the financial crisis in 2008. It took us more than 10 years to fully put America back to work after the financial crisis, and they had just started to see their wages going up. So this virus and this health crisis is deeply, deeply unfair in who it is targeting. I think the best thing that we could do as a country is to continue to put money in the hands of people who've lost their jobs. And since it's mostly lower educated, lower income people who've lost their jobs, putting money in their hands will be the best thing we could do to help them get through this crisis and get back to work.
Hmm. What are some of the other issues that you're seeing as far as how this pandemic is putting strain on or revealing other issues in our economy? What else is happening here?
Well, the small businesses are so important to every community in our nation. And they're also feeling huge burden right now. The coffee shops, the restaurants, the health clubs, et cetera. They employ millions and millions of Americans, and many of them have been shut. And now when we're moving to reopen, and I talked to some in South Dakota, you know, they want to reopen safely. But if they have to really socially distance inside a restaurant where they have half as many customers or a quarter of as many customers, how are they going to make ends meet? And is that a viable business model? And so if we end up seeing lots of bankruptcies of small businesses, that is not only going to hurt that firm and that community, that really means the recovery is going to be much slower. Because if you have a vacant restaurant or a vacant coffee shop with an out-of-business sign on it, it's going to take a year or two before a new firm can take that space over and start up a new restaurant or a new coffee shop. And so we need to really focus on trying to help small businesses. The Paycheck Protection Program was designed to do that. It was meant to be a two-month bridge. I think it's likely many of these small businesses are going to need a longer bridge than just a couple months. Hmm.
And for those of us who aren't business owners and maybe not feeling the worst of it right now, when we're looking ahead to the recovery, what should we anticipate in the aftermath? Are we looking at maybe taxes going up to recoup some of what went out? How does this play out after the fact?
Eventually, we will have to pay off this debt, and taxes may be part of it. Also, just stronger economic growth can help so that the economy grows faster than the debt. There will come a time for that. For the next couple of years, we need to focus on the recovery, helping our neighbors and our fellow Americans make ends meet until they can get back on the job market and have a good job and be able to take care of themselves. And I think that if you are unaffected by the crisis, I'm very fortunate. I'm able to work from home. Mm-hmm. My income has not been affected by this. You know, try to support your neighbors. I try, you know, we're eating in, we don't eat out very much at all anymore, but I do try to get takeout, you know, a few times a week from neighboring restaurants, just to try to provide them some business so they can try to make it through until we can get to a reopen, safe economy where we can all be confident again.
And before I let you go, Neil, I want to touch once more on, as we look ahead to the May jobs report, if people see we're already in a fairly historic rise as far as unemployment is concerned right now, what are your maybe key expectations for the May jobs report and kind of preliminary notes for people for what they should do next?
Well, I do think the unemployment rate, the official rate, is going to continue to climb. Some people say 20%, some people say 25%. Whatever it is, it's likely to understate the true depth of the damage. We're also really paying attention to these weekly unemployment claims, how many more people claim unemployment for the first time. Ultimately, you and I, all of your listeners, are going to determine how quickly the economy recovers, and that's when we have confidence that we can be safe, that we can take our families back out to restaurants, to sporting events, to movie theaters, to church, and be safe. And that means our healthcare system has to get control of the virus, either with much greater testing, with a vaccine, or with a therapy, so that we can all have confidence. That's going to be the key to getting our economy moving again.
With a noticeable uptick in COVID-19 cases West River, it's hard not to wonder if we're about to see another hotspot in South Dakota. Steve Allender is the mayor of Rapid City, and he joined us Tuesday to discuss the recent uptick in COVID-19 numbers in his city and his plan to protect the city's population.
Mayor Allender, welcome back to In the Moment. Thanks for taking the time to talk with us today.
Thanks for having me this morning.
So let's start with probably the most recent news this morning, receiving word that a Rapid City police officer has now tested positive for COVID-19, just the latest case in a kind of an uprise in your city. What can you tell us about that particular situation?
Well, I think it's one of those things we all assumed was going to happen, either with our, police officers, firefighters, paramedics, those frontline workers for the city. They're interacting with the public every day. So this is the first police officer who is homesick with COVID-19, although there's been a couple others that have tested positive for antibodies. There is close contact, and sometimes it's unavoidable. And, you know, the police-involved shooting the other night involved a suspect who was COVID-19 positive. So it's unavoidable, realistically.
I know Rapid City took some real stringent measures as far as businesses are concerned and things like that, probably one of the early communities to take those measures. Give us an update on what you're looking at as far as business restrictions and things like that in your city.
Well, the business restrictions that are in place right now are very realistic and common sense based restrictions. It requires spacing in restaurants and bars, safety precautions and warnings in other retail stores. And last night at the city council meeting, the council voted to extend that ordinance to give them the ability to continue to regulate through July. And then at the next city council meeting in 2 weeks, they will take up the resolution, which is the way they have chosen to alter the city ordinance. So the votes were 6-3 to keep that ordinance in place. So there's still strong support on the city council for it. But we're we're at the beginning of tourist season here, and there's a little bit of uncertainty about what that means for us.
Right. Talk to us a little bit more about that, because, of course, we're coming up to Memorial Day weekend, usually our sort of unofficial kickoff to summer and folks taking those trips. What's the initial feeling right now?
Well, the feeling is, of course, different for different people. You know, the tourism industry, the businesses are hoping to have a tourist season this year. There are a number of residents who fear that, you know, only the infected are going to come here and they're going to leave us with widespread disease and then go back home. And so there's a lot of fear, some of it irrational, but our population, if we have a near normal tourist season, our population in Rapid City will rise by, you know, 5,000 to 10,000 people on a daily basis. We have lots of folks here. So if there were people able to transmit the virus and they were here interacting with us, it could cause a spike. That's the statistical reality of it. But I think what's in question is really how much of a tourist season we're going to have. I think it's starting out slow. The reservations are slow. And we're a bit conflicted as far as how much to advertise and how much to try to be normal this tourist season.
Right. And I'm hearing there's this idea that you're anticipating somewhere around $6 million budget cuts in the city. A lot of that, I would imagine, having to do with tourist season and just all of the other restrictions and issues that we're dealing with right now. On the state level, the state seems to be a little less willing to put out those predictions just yet. Can you talk about how the city is kind of putting a finger on those initial numbers and ideas of where money needs to be moved around?
Well, they're projections. Mm-hmm. And even though I disclaim this every time I say it, I'm not sure if anyone really hears it, but they're projections and they'll change over time. One of the things we don't have to make these projections is real-time data. Mm-hmm. So we're projecting 6 months overall of pretty bleak economic activity here. We've based our projections on that. And the state sales tax submissions to the city come a month late just because of the way they're reported and distributed. So we'll start having real data around the end of this month and at the end of every month to follow. So that could change the projections. But we have to project, estimate. It's part of responsible budgeting because we're nearing half of the year going by already. And so we have to curtail our spending and start shutting down programs in order to make it to the end of the year with a positive balance. Cities can't go in debt for operations. We require a balanced budget. And so it's going to mean some changes for the people of Rapid City and for some of our visitors.
Hmm. And again, I'll reiterate your disclaimer. These are projections, but in anticipation of those projections, you talk about losing some programs. What are we looking at for some of those hard decisions?
Well, there will be the most noticeable, I think, for residents will be the recreation programs. Some of the normal programming through our ice rink and swim center will be postponed until September 1st. That's a huge disappointment to folks out there, especially our seniors who go to that swim center for their daily exercise. And the city swimming pools in our parks won't be open this year. And that is purely a financial decision, not a COVID-19 related decision. I mean, we didn't even have to weigh CDC guidelines on operation of swimming pools because we can't afford to operate them. there's an illusion, I think, that because kids pay an admittance fee and they buy potato chips or whatever at the concession stand there, that it must make some money or break even. But it's not true at all. It will cost taxpayers over and above admission fees about $5,000 a day to run the three swimming pools in our parks. And that's every day for 75 days. Mm. So about $385,000 out of pocket to keep the pools open for 2.5 months and a fairly limited, you know, number of kids and adults will participate in those pools. So that's going to be, you know, we're going to get some jabs over that one, but it's a, like I said, it's a financial decision.
Mm-hmm. Talk to us about, we had a conversation on our show yesterday about the statewide homeless count for 2020. And I know Rapid City has been looking at things that they can do for the population of folks experiencing homelessness right now. Bring us up to speed on some of that.
Well, there's homeless and then there's homeless. And as far as our typical emergency shelter goes, there has been reduced space in the shelter due mm-hmm. to distancing requirements, and we have a county care campus that's been open now for a year or so, and we're able to take some individuals there. But the part that's more related to our emergency actions are the chronic homeless, and those are folks that are out on the streets. They are not seeking treatment. They are, for the most part, unwilling to accept treatment or programming. They're living their life, and a high percentage of them are addicted. And so when they become ill, we anticipate that will spread through that community very rapidly because they do not concern themselves with hygiene or distancing. There's very close contact between this group of individuals. So when they become ill, we have an emergency shelter set up at our Civic Center where it's completely equipped to handle these individuals. We're funded to take care of them. They will require constant supervision. And we also think that there's probably a chance that not all of them are going to want to stay in the facility. And for people who are not addicted to something, a substance, it might be difficult to understand. But in the middle of the night, when someone hasn't had a drink for a while, they'll do anything to find one. And so if we have an infected individual that is set on leaving the emergency shelter, then we're going to have a monitoring problem that we're going to have to deal with and perhaps require the state to intervene with a public health emergency declaration. And worst case scenario, that individual can be taken into custody to protect the rest of the community from infection. So it's kind of complicated and clunky, but it's one of those scenarios that I think none of us imagined we would ever be talking about here in 2020, but that's a reality of it. So we're set up. The infrastructure is there. The procedures are there. We have a rumor as of yesterday of an infected homeless individual. We haven't seen any yet. And so we're gearing up for that. But so far, as far as the traditional homeless shelter, the Cornerstone Rescue Mission seems to be doing okay. And so we're taking each day as it comes.
Can you talk a little bit about, I don't think you mean to generalize, but kind of that distinction between folks who are truly unwilling to seek those services and just a matter of access, which I'm sure exacerbated by the current situation, like shelters not being able to take in as many people and things like that. As far as like addiction services in the area, do you have any insight on how they're responding to our unique situation right now?
Well, generally speaking, the human services provider community is doing a good job. They're seeing increases in referrals. So I think access is okay right now for individuals seeking help. In fact, there's a chance with all the attention on mental health related issues, it could actually be better right now. But that's for people who want help, who see there's a problem, who don't choose to deal with it on their own anymore. And there's a huge difference between that individual and someone who we would classify as a chronic homeless, who's been living on the street, living on their own for a number of years and refuses to accept any help or programming. So there's not an access issue there, because they turn the other way when it comes to programs or treatment facilities.
Are there?
Not sure if that answered your question.
Yeah. I'm curious about if there is suspicion or something as far as access for people who are homeless who may believe that they have COVID-19 symptoms or something like that. I'm thinking about the state's announcement about mass testing in nursing homes and other communal living situations.
Oh.
Have you heard about any conversations about mass testing in shelters like we've talked about, or access for folks who maybe don't have a primary care provider, like we've been told we should call a primary care provider if we're concerned about symptoms?
No, I haven't heard any suggestions or comments about mass testing in shelters. Of course, we haven't identified an outbreak at the shelters yet. But, you know, access to testing is very, very low anyway.
Mm.
I think the state's average is about 14% of everyone tested is positives, because the testing protocol is very targeted and, you know, not testing everyone who walks through the door and is curious if they might have COVID. But as far as the individuals, such as the homeless, and in Rapid City, I mean, our primary minority population is Native American, and we have a Native American health system here. And so there's good access there. They're doing a lot of testing, finding quite a few positive test results lately. But those results, those testing supplies are becoming very limited. So they're testing fewer people, waiting for a resupply. And I think that's one of the most frustrating things with this whole pandemic. Is I don't think it was 5 minutes after we heard on the news that there was a pandemic that we also heard that there was a global shortage of testing supplies. And, you know, that's been months now, and we still cannot catch up to the testing demand. But I think we ought to be testing enough people so that that positive rate is maybe a third or a fourth of what it is now. To give us some real feeling of security, so that we have a better idea how the disease is progressing in our communities.
Right.
So access generally is denied. Access for the homeless individual even more limited because of the circles they run in. If they get sick, they may just lay down wherever they are rather than seek help. And no, you know, transportation's an issue if they want to go to the doctor somewhere. So they would typically rely on the ambulance or other first responders to deal with them. and make those referrals. So right. It's a system that doesn't really guarantee great service, because to a good extent, there's a less than willing patient who may really need a test for their own benefit and for the benefit of the community. It's just really confusing and frustrating to try to navigate all of these little glitches in the system.
South Dakota tribes are maintaining sovereignty regarding their COVID-19 checkpoints. Meanwhile, more and more South Dakota businesses are reopening. Many are wondering, is it too soon? The Dakota Political Junkies joined us Wednesday to discuss these topics and more.
It's good to have the Dakota Political Junkies back for more discussion. John Schaff is professor of political science at Northern State University in Aberdeen. Welcome back, John.
Thanks for having me again.
And John Hunter is publisher of the Madison Daily Leader. He's back for more as well. John Hunter, right. Welcome back.
Thanks, Lori. Thanks for the invitation.
I want to start with you, John Hunter, because you wrote a column recently about, and we're going to get into this whole idea of, you know, how the federal government is thinking about economic stabilization and stimulus, how state government is thinking about that, what needs to happen next with unemployment and such. And you say, let's look to history a little bit for some ideas about what might be needed next. Give us start us off with what are you thinking about when you think about how to handle this massive unemployment that we're looking at and what it could mean for the days ahead?
Well, it kind of struck me that, you know, we're making natural comparisons to other big recessions or even the Great Depression, where you had high unemployment, and how do you get out of that? And I think we learned some things from the Great Depression that that federal government can play a role, a good role in getting that too. But you remember, of course, the WPA projects and so forth were popular and helping employ people. Now this is, you know, 90 years ago or so, 80 to 90 years ago when this was all taking place. But the thing that kind of struck me was this kind of a subset of that called the Civilian Conservation Corps that President Roosevelt created in 1933. And the idea was, yes, same thing as employing people, young people in that case, but it was almost entirely on conservation ideas. So anywhere from tree planting to building parks and wildlife refuges and so forth. And so if global warming is an issue today, which we all agree it is. Well, not everyone agrees, I guess, but then let's do that. I understand the value of sending out checks to people and letting them spend it the way they want, but employment, it could be very valuable for many people, and there are now a lot of young people that are unemployed during this time. You know, out of the 33 million Americans that have been laid off in the last couple of months, great deal of them are, you know, probably nearly 8 million are younger than 30 years old.
Yeah.
And so I think we could put together a jobs program, a work program that could hit two different great ideas. One, employing people, giving them something to do, some valuable work, and also helping combat global warming.
And this is there's a lot of energy for this right now, too. You see a lot of high school students and, you know, trying to figure out whether they need to take a gap year. What are they going to do next? College students graduating into a really terrible time to be a new college students. And you also see a lot of energy around climate change and global warming and figuring out what is sustainability and whatnot. Seems like a pretty good match to put those two things together. What kind of impact, when you look back at history, John Hunter, you know, the impact of a program like that, and we're still talking about it 90 years later.
Well, in this case, I think it was an extraordinarily successful program. Generally, WPA was considered a big success. It was actually slightly smaller than I think what people remember it, just kind of anecdotally. There weren't as many people. They eliminated, people who were you know, farmers, because they were doing other important work like feeding America and so on. So it ended up not being as many, but there were a lot of people who worked in this. I think a little bit more than 3 million people were in the CCC, Civilian Conservation Corps, mostly young people. And I think you could argue, I think, that it may have helped set up some of the greatest generation kind of stuff that we now think of. They may have been 20 years old in the 30s. They may have gone to war in the 40s. They may have come back and built America in the 50s. And so just from the top of my head, I wasn't there, despite how old you might think I am. But it seemed like it really, I think it may have been game-changing for America, some of these programs during the Great Depression. And maybe we could recreate those now.
John Schaff, what comes to mind first when you think about programs like this and think about what they have to inform what we're doing today and the problems that we're facing today?
Well, I think John's really on to something, which is, there are a couple things. What did the CCC do back in the 1930s? And there were a lot of those programs occurred. That those conservation activities occurred right here in the state of South Dakota. There's evidence of CCC programs all over our state, and what it does, the purpose of an economy is not simply to put people to work, but to do something productive. And I think what John's talking about is there are productive things we can do with labor instead of simply taking money and giving it to people. Can we give people the opportunity to do something productive? That means it will sustain economic value over time, because now we have things like dams and roads and these sorts of things, bridges, all sorts of things you could do that it might have economic value that they were doing back in the 30s with CCC and the WPA. But also, I think you were onto something, Lori. There's a cottage industry now with people writing fake graduation speeches because we don't have any graduation exercises. And one of them was David Brooks wrote a nice one for The Atlantic a couple weeks ago. And one of the things he said was that maybe what young people should do, because it's going to be a rough couple economic years, is just go do whatever you want and don't worry about whether you make money doing it, make a lot of money doing it. If you want to go somewhere, go there, and if you can get a job that you can survive on, just do that for a while and have an experience instead of, I need to start my career right now, because, of course, everything, we're kind of in a economic interruptus right now, and so it's a bad time to start your career. So this programmer, something that sort of mirrors what John's talking about would be an opportunity, at least for some young people, to say, hey, did you always want to go to this place and work outside and do something? Well, here, we're going to allow you to do that, and there's going to be all these other benefits, these public benefits from that, depending on what kind of project they end up working on.
Well, John, because and John Lori, too, the other thing, too, with that is that this might be, it's possible, every survey I've ever seen about conservation or kind of global warming issues is that it's much more important to young adults than it is to older adults. And so you might have just possibly the most enthusiastic jobs program ever invented, right? I mean, some jobs program forcing you to do things you don't want to do. This might be, you might be filled with young people who want to do this exact thing.
Yeah. And when we send checks to, to individuals, here's your stimulus check. We are incurring debt for that. John Schaff, what from a national debt or deficit perspective, it matters what you invest in a lot of ways. There's a big difference between just giving. I mean, clearly people need to pay their rent too. I'm not minimizing that. There's a stabilization aspect to this, and then there's a stimulus aspect to it. But as we look at big programs in the days ahead, what we invest in matters for how it's in quotations paid for in the future, right? So that becomes part of the conversation too, doesn't it?
Yeah, and that's what I mean. The checks that Well, I've gotten mine. I don't know if you guys have gotten yours, but I've gotten mine. I call it my Trump dollars. I got mine. And so that CARES Act money that many of us have gotten, everybody will get it eventually as the summer goes along. Well, it really was designed simply because to allow people to pay bills and kind of maintain a status quo in their lives. But I don't know how much of that was designed to actually stimulate the economy. And that's what I mean, is that you don't really create economic activity from taking money from one group and giving it to another group, or borrowing money and just spending it. It's got to be on something productive, so the proverbial example of we could hire people to dig holes and fill them in and that would stimulate the economy. That's not true, because digging holes and filling them in is not productive labor. That's just a waste of money. And so we are at this point, we have to borrow large amounts of money from our future in order to take care of things now. Even before the COVID crisis, we had debt problems, and now it's only going to be exacerbated. So we at least have to be thinking a little about, as we spend money, we want to make sure we're spending money on things that are actually productive. If we've stabilized a little bit, and to a certain extent, we're going to have to keep doing that. There's going to be an element of our population that simply is going to need money from the public in order to survive. But then as we think of getting our economy going, you can't just spend on anything. It's got to be something that there's actually economic productivity behind it. Like saying that, and infrastructure is a great example of productive use of public dollars, because you build a road, people use the road. It's infrastructure. It allows for more economic activity and more productive activity. And these are the kinds of things that I think, as we start maybe thinking of at least a medium and longer term as opposed to the short term, these are the kinds of things that we have to be thinking about.
Yeah. Now, John Schaff, my younger brother, owns an irrigation business, and a large part of his day is filling holes. Digging holes and then filling them in. So I could it's for a reason.
Really digging holes and filling them in.
He is not. There are many things that happen in the interim. However, yeah. I can imagine him in his truck with his crew right now listening to the radio on the way to his next job, saying, "Well, Professor, I'm quite good at it."
Well, I remember when we had the crisis of 2008, 2009-ish. And I think I'm not going to name names. I can't remember who exactly it was, but claimed that the United States government could pay for and build like 10,000 tanks and then dump them into the ocean, and that would be okay because we kept defense contractors employed, right? That stimulated the economy. But that's what I'm talking about, is we don't just do nothing and expect that it's going to stimulate the economy. So your brother is engaged in very productive hole digging.
Yes, indeed.
His production increase.
Thank you. Let's talk about elections and going back as we talk about my younger brother, who's in business right now and trying to figure out how to stay afloat as a small business owner. Lots of people are having that question, and COVID numbers are we're monitoring them pretty closely every day. Businesses are trying to figure out how to open. We've got an election coming up. There's a lot happening right now. John, let's talk. John Schaff, let's start with you and talk elections. And as we come closer to a June 2nd primary, to city council elections across the state,
mm-hmm.
Lots to think about. Where do you want to begin?
Well, I just think that I've been noticing, here in Aberdeen, there was I think probably almost everybody who listens to this knows that the state's actual dictates, you might say, on shelter in place and closing things down were pretty minimal. But as a municipality, the city of Aberdeen passed a relatively stringent ordinance shutting down things like restaurants, the barbershops, hair salons, that sort of thing. And then it was, I got to think of my dates here, about 3 weeks ago, we started to ease up on that. But this, mm-hmm. but you could see these debates, a lot of the debates that we're having nationally were occurring locally, of this balance between we want to ensure public safety versus you know, I've got to make a living, this sort of thing, or no, people need to get outside, this sort of, you know, should we, for example, our public parks were closed. And I think I said this on a previous show that they had literally taken police tape and wrapped up the slides in the jungle gym so you couldn't climb on them. And so we started to, but you could see on our city council debates, and this has leaked into some of our, we have, like most places, we have some road, you know, it's staggered, the city council districts, or city council elections. So we've got a couple of our city council districts that are up for re-election. You can see that there is these fights or these disagreements are spilling over a little bit into city council races, as you've got people who are like incumbents who are more on the side of we need to be more on the side of public safety. I have picked up challengers that are, I'm on more on the side of opening up business because we can't have all of our small businesses fail. And so it's just interesting to see this national debate that we're having is being echoed in very local politics. And even though within our community, we can see people disagreeing about what exactly is the proper balance between economics and public health, and at what point does bad economics itself become a public health problem when you've got so many people out of work and economic stagnation. I think of something like some of you saw the news story of last week that Mayo Clinic is projecting losing $900 million this year. Well, mm-hmm. How many hundreds of millions of dollars does Mayo Clinic lose before it has a public health consequence? These are the sort of things that I think we have to talk about, and it's happening even in very local elections, and I see it right here in Aberdeen.
John Hunter, is there also an opportunity for people to really talk about leadership, whether it's you're an incumbent and you feel like you had really strong leadership and, you know, you did certain things versus, you know, a challenger who might, you know, look for chinks in the armor and say, you know, that so some of it just being philosophy of and policy, what kind of ordinances did we pass, but the consequences of even, you know, messaging and communication and that kind of behavior. A lot of this has happened and it continues to happen right in the midst of, you know, we haven't reached our peak yet. What do you think, John Hunter?
Well, I think you're spot on, Lori, and that I think it does change the dialogue a little bit toward leadership. You know, I think the idea of anticipatory stuff rather than reactionary, and so this, you know, there were some who could see this tsunami coming, and others who didn't. And it's all of a sudden, it's a, do we wait until there are cases in our city before we do anything, or is there something we can do to anticipate it? But then, yes, I think you switch a little bit to, you know, we got to figure out how we're going to balance long and short-term things. There's certainly governments of at all levels, way down to the fire district or to the township, where you say, look, we got to get through this year successfully, but also we have to make plans for beyond this year. And so I think it's a great opportunity for some people to make a difference in their communities if they're serious about it. And I think the challenge is, you know, none of these public service elected positions are particularly lucrative. It's in a lot of cases it's kind of part volunteer, right? So even at the state legislature level, it's, you know, a couple of months of full time and then part time the rest of the year. But if you're serious about it, if you like your state, if you like your local district, whatever that is, I think there are great opportunities to both make kind of get through the short term and make great plans for the long term.
What have we learned? This is a big question, but what have we learned if you are considering running for office? The challenges that you might face for some of those low-paying jobs, and you know, as we think of some of the more high-profile leaders of a Governor Kristi Noem or a Mayor Paul Tengenhagen from Sioux Falls, who's on the national news, I think everybody who's thinking about running might be more inspired to run, but also has to have an awareness that once you take office, almost anything can happen in your term, and you better be ready for it. John Schaff, do you think that candidates are learning the seriousness or the weight of asking for those positions, asking voters to trust them with that kind of responsibility.
I think so, and sort of going on with what John Hunter was saying is, you know, I think most people, when they get into, especially, you know, very local politics, you can't say it's thankless work, but it's certainly it's not financially lucrative work, and so you're doing it at really as an amateur, someone who does it for the love of it. And then suddenly what we found, you know, a couple months ago or, you know, 3 months ago, is suddenly we're asking people who are kind of part-time people who are not paid very much, and they sort of do it because they like it, to make really earth-shattering decisions. And suddenly you've got major responsibilities that people's lives and livelihood might be heavily affected by decisions that your county commission or your city council makes. And it certainly makes something that is normally, you know, kind of a part-time job, suddenly it takes on all sorts of consequences that we never really thought that these sort of jobs would have. And I think what, you know, a lesson to those of us who are voters is that as you assess candidates, surely we look at what our policy preferences are and how they match up with the candidates who are running. But it's also why we need to assess character, because almost inevitably at some point in somebody's term, something is going to come up which we never could have anticipated. And knowing someone's position on a policy from the election isn't going to help you, because something comes along that nobody would have thought of. And so then it's about how does a particular character deal with something that's unexpected, and who do you trust in a time of crisis or when a really hard decision has to be made? It's not just about policy preferences, although those are important. It's also assessing somebody's character.
And stamina in some ways as well.
Well,
we need to know.
Yeah, we've certainly seen that.
Yeah.
Well, and thickness of skin, too. I mean, if you have...
Yeah.
You know, that whatever decisions you make, there, you know, we have a broad diversity of opinions in our communities, and so there will be people who oppose your decision. And I think you have to learn this: that it's not a job for people who need gratification from 100% of their constituents. I think you need to be able to gain satisfaction from making good decisions, even if they're sometimes opposed by some. So I think there can be a lot of job satisfaction. As John Chaff was describing, I think you probably end up looking to your character as much as anything. I said, I realize this may not be popular with even my friends, but I think it's an absolutely right thing to do for our community, and you have to gain enough satisfaction from that to overcome the phone call you get from your friend.
if you're running for office right now because you want adulation from the public, you picked the wrong time to run for office. Because no matter what, I mean, this is always true, but it's doubly true now when we're faced with bad choice versus bad choice. And no matter what we do public policy-wise, there are going to be dire consequences. There are going to be bad consequences for somebody. It might be economic bad consequences. It might be health bad consequences, whatever it is. And so this is why, you know, we cry out probably more than ever of what we need is leadership, as opposed to, you know, people who might just be interested in public adulation or posing or, you know, simply advancing a career. Is that because no matter who's in office, and this is, you know, from local now all the way up to national, the ability to make a decision and to convince people when you make that you're being serious and that you're not being frivolous in your decision making. This is, I think, probably needed more than ever.
This past January was the day of the 2020 homeless count. Suzanne Smith is Associate Vice President for Enterprise Data Analytics at Augustana Research Institute, and she joined the program Monday to detail the results of this year's count.
So remind us again what times of year this count happens. Is it a once a year thing or multiple times a year?
You bet. So the point in time homeless count in South Dakota is typically conducted once a year. federally, HUD requires that communities do this count at least every other year. We've done it typically every year. And federal law also requires that this count happen in the middle of winter, really. It has to happen the last 10 days in January during that window. And so in 2020, here in South Dakota, we conducted the point-in-time count on January 28th.
Hmm. And walk us through some of your preliminary findings. What did we find out this year?
Sure. So I really led the efforts here in the Sioux Falls area. And so I've poured through the data a little bit, looked at the state numbers. I know the local numbers for Sioux Falls a little bit better. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a bit of a mixed bag in reviewing the results. So
right.
The total count of people who were experiencing homelessness on that single night in January was up just slightly. Statewide, we saw a 6% increase in the number of people who were counted compared to the previous year. And here in Sioux Falls, that was a 3% increase.
Wow.
Now, given, you know, the general variation, that's not a huge difference. Mm-hmm. Numbers have held fairly steady here in Sioux Falls, going back to about 2017, sort of right around 300 to 350 people who have been counted on that night in the Sioux Falls area.
Mm-hmm. It's hard. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, as we dig in a little bit, you know, part of the purpose of the count is to better understand the population components and the characteristics of people who are experiencing homelessness on a given night. So, you know, as we dig into some of those different subpopulations, there are some bright spots and I think maybe some troubling numbers as well that we can sure get into.
Yeah, let's go ahead and do that because I have a question about how you categorize the numbers because a lot of, well, like you say, there's a lot of different demographics and characteristics of folks that find themselves in this situation.
Yeah, you bet. So I think, you know, to start off with some of the good news, statewide and here in Sioux Falls as well, the number of veterans who are counted is down. In Sioux Falls, we saw a 50% decrease in the number of veterans who were experiencing homelessness on that single night. And statewide, that number was down 35%. So that's great news. You know, we want to see numbers moving in that direction. In Sioux Falls here, we also saw a higher proportion of people who were sheltered on that night. So fewer people who were sort of out on the street, exposed to the elements. More people were staying somewhere where they had at least a roof over their head, emergency shelter, transitional housing, something like that. We had 95% of the people who were counted in Sioux Falls were sheltered. So that, again, is good news that people are at least have a place to stay. But at the same time, here in Sioux Falls and statewide, we did see an uptick in the number of youth who were counted, as well as an uptick in the number of people who were chronically homeless.
Explain that term, chronically homeless. Maybe it's self-explanatory, but what are the qualifications for that?
You bet. So I think it seems self-explanatory, but of course it is subject to a legal definition. So for HUD, for the point-in-time count, someone is considered chronically homeless if they have been experiencing homelessness for a year or longer, or if they have had four or more bouts of homelessness, occasions of homelessness, over the last 3 years. And those different times of being homelessness add up to 12 months or more.
Interesting.
So this is, you know, someone who has either been homeless for quite a long time, 12 months or longer, or they've really been sort of cycling in and out of homelessness for years. And that number, statewide, we saw about 62% growth in the number of people who would be considered chronically homeless who were counted. Here in Sioux Falls, it more than doubled. The number who would be considered chronically homeless here in Sioux Falls who were counted in January was up to 72 this past January.
Wow. What can we glean from that information? I'll focus in on the chronically homeless numbers. What should we take away from the fact that those are rising in a fairly substantial way in particular areas? What does that tell us?
Sure. Well, I think, you know, most people who experience homelessness experience it for a short amount of time. And with support and maybe a little help, they get back on their feet and things turn around. Chronic homelessness can be a different situation for people and often requires a different type of support. Evidence suggests that the best approach to addressing chronic homelessness is not temporary shelter. It's not emergency shelter. That's just not deep enough support to help people who have been homeless for a long time. What works better is providing folks with permanent housing, often with social services and supports available on site or connected to that housing. But it's the permanentness of the housing that's really important. And then having really sort of low barriers, not a lot of rules or restrictions that would get someone kicked out of that housing. So having the stability of a permanent place to live gives people the foundation that they need to begin putting other pieces in their lives in place, back together, to end that cycle and end that chronic state of homelessness. So I think it suggests that communities should be thinking hard about the mix of services that are available and whether there's enough of that permanent housing to serve people who are experiencing longer-term homelessness.
It's hard not to think about the fact that this point in time measurement happened in late January, before COVID, and we've heard conversations throughout this situation about concerns about increased homelessness and other kind of ripples of the impact the pandemic is having. I wonder how that plays in. Is that something that we likely won't see officially quantified until late January next year? How do you monitor that throughout the year in unique situations like this?
Right. That's a great question. I think that one of the drawbacks of the point in time count is exactly that. It's not great for monitoring changes or shocks that happen over the course of the year. So in order to compare these numbers to some of the fallout of COVID, you're right, we won't see that until January. There are other ways to track and try to keep a handle on what is happening with homelessness. Statewide, some providers participate in a homeless management information system, a sort of a centralized database where they would be able to track these changes. Individual shelters certainly have been reporting on the demand that they continue to see. Another metric that people commonly turn to sort of track the state of homelessness in a community is to look at the counts that school districts keep of students and their families who may experience homelessness during the year. And so we will have some visibility on changes. And, you know, COVID raises a lot of concerns for people who might experience homelessness, not only you know, people who may be staying in shelters and may have more trouble being able to isolate or socially distance, but people who may be exposed to the threat or vulnerabilities becoming homeless because of lost income or because of domestic violence situations that could arise as people are quarantining at home, things like that. So it's a really multifaceted problem that intersects homelessness in a lot of ways.
On Tuesday, the U.S. Department of Agriculture announced details of direct assistance to farmers and ranchers through the Coronavirus Food Assistance Program. The CFAP will provide up to $16 billion in direct payments to deliver relief to America's farmers and ranchers impacted by the coronavirus pandemic. Joining us Thursday to answer questions about eligibility, how to receive assistance, and how this impacts South Dakota was Kevin McNew. He's chief economist for the Farmers Business Network.
Welcome back. Thanks for being here. We appreciate your time.
Hi, Lori. Thanks for having me back.
All right. This is a new program. Tell us a little bit about the problem that is really needs to be addressed right now. Why a new program now at this particular time?
Yeah, I mean, just like the broader U.S. economy is struggling with the effects of coronavirus, so too is the farm economy. We find ourselves in kind of the downturn of an economy shut down, especially as it relates to corn. And in South Dakota, where corn is becoming king and we have a great deal of ethanol plants, you know, the hardships from coronavirus are just widespread. You know, ethanol production is just catapulted lower. Plants have had to idle and shut down substantially as a result of drivers not moving and cars not consuming gas. And so the impact has been widespread across the corn market in particular as a result of this coronavirus. So farmers that, you know, have been holding grain and hoping for better prices find themselves in pretty dire situations here.
All right. So let's talk about who is eligible for some of these direct payments.
Yeah, I think probably the most important take-home message is it really depends on if you had farm inventories of crops or livestock at a certain point in time. And for grains, it's really starting there, the USDA program starts looking at your inventories that were not sold or priced yet as of January 15th, so kind of predating the coronavirus pandemic. And they're looking at that point in time to say, did you have unsold or unpriced inventories? And then looking at how much the price declined for specific crops between that time period and about mid-April, when kind of the deepest trough of the financial impacts were felt. And so the rates vary. Corn has around a 32 cent a bushel payment rate on crop that you had in storage or unpriced at that time. Soybeans is a little bit different, wheat's a little bit different. And so it really is going to be different for each farmer. You know, a farmer who maybe took all his crop in the fall and sold it off the combine to a local co-op or to an ethanol plant, he's probably not going to get any payments because he didn't have anything in inventory.
So it's a nuanced report. And some of the criticism from the last, you know, direct payments during the trade war was that some of those payments were going, you know, to large farms, and so many of them didn't get to the place that they needed to be. Do we think that, that this is an effort to really make a nuanced approach to make sure things are specific to the need, or how hard is that to even do?
Yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, it's exceptionally hard to do because, you know, farming is a scale business. It's you know, family farms are large farms for the most part. And just because they're large farms doesn't mean they're more or less impacted. It just means that they're, you know, they need more payment. So I understand kind of the outside observer saying that's a critique of farm policy, but the reality is, a lot of our family farms are what we would consider pretty large farms already, and the impacts are important. And so when USDA goes to design these policies, they sort of have to level the playing field by making payments based on per bushel, per unit of output or something like that, which, you know, in some sense, you know, gives the larger farmers who produce more output a bigger paycheck. But again, they also have more investment in that crop on a dollar basis. So I can't be critical of USDA around this because it is a challenge. One thing I would say for those who are concerned about large farms getting payments, there are usually, and in this case, there are cap rates. There are rates at which they can't go above certain payment levels, certain payment thresholds. So that sort of prevents kind of massive payments to bigger farms.
Tell us a little bit about when this all kicks off, because we've, you know, had concerns with the payroll protection program and, you know, money running out and people going through SBA. And so when a new program launches, people want to know if it's really set to function administratively well, and when does it begin? How do people apply?
Right. So that's going to be interesting. It's a quick rollout. The paperwork can be submitted May 26th. That's the start date of the program. It does have applications going all the way to August, so it's not like it's a hard deadline. But it can start in 5 days, so farmers can get those applications in. My understanding of the payments you'll get 80% of the payment right away, and then they're still suggesting they'll hold back 20%. depending on funding and financing. So that's a little bit ambiguous right now as to what that means. But it seems like, you know, there can be a fairly quick cash infusion of at least 80% of that payment fairly quickly.
You mentioned early in our conversation, you know, ethanol, and I'm wondering, you know, cars sitting idle because people aren't going as many places. Things are starting to churn in the direction of movement again. What do you think about the impact on the ethanol industry of economies, state economies across the country starting to reopen and sort of testing things out? What's ahead?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, this has been just an unparalleled moment in time of, you know, not only the U.S. economy, but specifically, you know, consumers and their driving habits. And, you know, we have new data that we watch around cell phones is kind of a metric of how much consumers are moving. And of course, we're tracking gasoline consumption and things like that. But what we've seen is, as you suggest, a kind of returning to normal. I don't want to say we're back to normal. We still have a ways to go, but the metrics are getting better. We're seeing, I think at the lows, we probably saw gasoline consumption off about 40% from normal. And that was at the deepest part of this trough. And now we're probably somewhere around 20% off from normal. So it's getting better, slowly, you know, moving towards that. I don't anticipate that we get back to normal quickly. I think it's a slow and kind of methodical approach. And obviously, you know, expectations abound around what normal will look like in, say, 3 months or 6 months. But we're moving in the right direction. As for ethanol plants, I think what's encouraging, and of course they've fared a big brunt of this storm, we're actually seeing their levels of profitability start to rise, and they're actually at better levels now than they were even heading into the coronavirus, which is somewhat surprising. But what's been going on is the price of corn has dropped so rapidly, and ethanol is kind of, you know, it dropped rapidly as well, but it's kind of recovered a little bit. And then, you know, ethanol plants also produce the byproduct called DDGs, which is an important value proposition, and that has been a premium as of late because of the cutdown in ethanol production, which meant lower DDG supplies. So on balance, ethanol plants are actually doing better now than they were heading into the coronavirus. And so we're starting to see them start to open up. We're starting to see more production coming back. Not, again, not where we were before, but there's some light at the end of the tunnel, hopefully.
Yeah. And we just have a minute or so left, Kevin, but I do want to ask you, when we went into this, one of the reasons this was so tough on South Dakota farmers, the pandemic and you know, changes in the supply chain, was because we were coming off of flooding and coming off of a trade war with China. And I'm wondering about that global picture now, because this has been such a global story. What's ahead for our relations with China and getting U.S. products abroad again?
Yeah, exceptionally challenging situation there. I mean, you know, we spoke a month or so ago, just after the trade war had been inked, or the trade war deal had been inked, and, you know, we were reasonably optimistic that China would be buying. And in fairness to China, you know, they were given kind of an economic pass, if you will. They were allowed to basically buy as the market dictated, and it was not our time in the season to be big sellers of ag commodities. So our time usually is in late summer into our winter. That's usually when we're big sellers of commodities to China. And they had been picking up as of late. Their economy is also trying to recover from COVID. And, you know, we're seeing their stockpiles starting to rebuild, their animal herd starting to rebuild. So everything's trying to move in the right direction. So I'm cautiously optimistic about what the next year will bring in terms of China trade. But what concerns me is the political risk. You know, there's obviously a lot of finger pointing going on about the COVID and was there a cover up and this kind of stuff. So I'm hopeful that we don't enter into another economic warfare situation with China, because we desperately need that catalyst to move our agricultural products.
Now that's the show for this week. Thank you for joining us. Again, if you're looking for an individual segment from our radio program, you can find all of our segments at listen.sdpb.org or by following the In the Moment Segments podcast. And if you have a story idea, send an email to inthemoment@sdpb.org. For Lori Walsh and Chris Loffrey, I'm Josh Heyer. Thank you for listening.